internet. This one's mysterious, even for me. My name is Matthew Kroll.
And do you think other people see you naked? My name is Shahir Dowd.
And this is the only podcast about movies, specifically the film Dream Scenario.
Oh, Dream
Scenario. Oh, no, we're not.
Yeah,
oh.
No, sorry.
I do believe you can get me through the night. Yay, look at that. We're on.
We're in tune.
Listen, we are not going to get any better than this. So thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
I'm excited about this episode because you and I have not spoken. We've not mentioned any. There's been no ticks back and forth about this film. We do try to avoid each other generally.
Yeah.
But I feel like I have no... I have no read on whether you like this movie or not.
Sure.
I have none whatsoever.
I mean, same.
So I'm very curious how this all plays out. I'm also, I listened to a bunch of podcasts, read a bunch of reviews this week about this movie, and I was genuinely surprised by the reaction.
Really?
Yeah, genuinely surprised.
I'm glad you did that. I did not, sadly. I watched it and I've pondered it and I wrote a couple things down, but I didn't get to do my normal
I'm
sort
just
of
looking at your note. I
deep
hate
divey
this
thing.
Movie.
Yeah.
A strange thing to write.
No. This one was one that I asked about.
Yes, you did. Yeah.
Because I saw the trailers forever ago, and by forever ago, I mean last year.
Yeah.
And I was so, like, just into it. Like, I thought the idea, like, so a little.
I mean, if you went for jujitsu, why would you not go for this?
Here's what, spoiler alert, this movie is better than jujitsu.
Okay, well, all right, that's the first surprise.
So buckle up. No, I wanted to see this movie because I've always had...
a love affair with Nicolas Cage.
Yes, and
Nicolas Coppola.
A discussion. I love. I don't believe anything I'm about to say, but I love the idea of interconnected dream work.
Okay.
It's been something that I've been obsessed with from a narrative perspective and just sort of a, ooh, that's neat, what if perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think since I realized, you know, you could start sort of dissecting or talking about dreams. Mm-hmm. I'm not a huge like, ooh, let's talk about dreams or figure out what they mean sort of person. I'm a, what if there is a different sort of dreamscape subconscious that our brains are all going to and that are connected and blah, 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 blah. So like when this movie hit, I was just like, yep, this one's for me.
Okay.
Because I don't know. I haven't really seen too many films sort of explore this a ton. I think this is not the same thing.
Yeah.
But The Cell.
Cell, great.
It's not the same. Like
she goes into
things.
His subconscious, right?
Yes. So yeah. It's not like dream.
Dream logic, I think, is one of those interesting things that you know. There are probably dreamologists, sleepologists, sure. Dream people,
and
Care Bears that listen to this and the show and will have thoughts about what we all about.
Of course,
about
absolutely, professionals. Please email us in onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com and tell us how wrong about everything we are. But.
There's an old Nightmare on Elm Street as well.
That's right. Yeah. Telling us how we are wrong is our kink.
Okay.
but I've always liked stories that are like this, and I really was interested in sort of seeing what a Nick Cage version of diving into this weird stuff is. And the other side of the coin is dreams are such a cinematic shorthand and or language.
Mm-hmm.
Like so many movies have dream sequences, whether whether they're sequences that are shot for the audience not to realize it's a dream until it starts getting weird and the character wakes up, or you see the character go to sleep and we get to see a fantastical or horrific thing that's happening in their subconscious. Like they're everywhere.
Yeah. It's a really good question is what was the first, and I'm typing this in Google. What was the first dream sequence
in a movie?
Now, the first I can remember is probably like a Salvador Dali film.
Sure.
In a movie. But
The Wizard of Oz isn't a dream, is it?
Oh, this is great.
What is it?
Film critic Bob Mandello claims that the first famous movie with a dream sequence was Buster Keaton's Sherlock Jr.
Huh.
Predating this, Leslie Halpin claims the earliest dream sequence was from Edwin S. Porter's Life of an American Fireman. Yeah, you're right. There is an entire Wikipedia page about dream sequences.
Yeah.
Probably there are two famous examples that I can think of the top of my head. There is a film that is about dreams, but yet every critic or every person I've talked to about this has agreed that this film doesn't feel like it's about the dreams that we all have, mm-hmm. which is Inception, Christopher Nolan's film, right. Inception. That's a film that's ostensibly about the process of dreaming, a dream heist, but never quite feels like a dream per se. Then there, the one sequence that always comes to mind if we think about dream sequences is in Mulholland Drive, when a character is describing what their dream sequence, what their dream is, and then we walk outside to see sort of a rendition of that.
Yes.
And it's a terrifying sequence. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at a page here of movies about dreams. I actually purchased this film a couple of weeks ago. It was Akira Kurosawa's film, Dreams, mm-hmm. which is, you know, it's sort of more like What Dreams May Come.
Yes.
You know, which is that it's lucid dreaming, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then the other one that I just, you know, I'm being prompted by this page was, Michel Gondry's film, The Science of Sleep, which I remember, you know, it fuses the idea of what Michel Gondry does visually with the idea of dreams.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool. Like I didn't love that movie, but you know, it's kind of cool. You're right. Dreams are a big functional part of movies because in a way, I can't remember who said this, but it was either a filmmaker who said movies are dreams.
I mean, I'm sure many a filmmaker
have said that movies are dreams. Yeah. And it's kind of like they enter into your subconscious in a profound way. For me, there's this interesting thing, which is that when I dream when I have dreams, I often dream that the thing I am dreaming is a movie.
Okay.
So I see it as a movie, and sometimes I will be in it as a character, but I will be aware that what is happening is a movie. And then sometimes I will step out of it and be watching it as though it's a movie with other characters in it.
Is in those moments, this is the sort of the third dimension of that. Is it a lucid dream or are you not aware that it is a dream and you're just sort of experiencing it?
I had, I can't remember what project I worked on, but there was some project I was working on when someone talked about like the how to lucid dream. And I remember trying it. And the thing was to look at a clock and to specifically seek out a clock in your dreams. And if you can understand that it's playing backwards or not playing in linear time, then you can acknowledge that was the first step to lucid dreaming, was to understand that you are now in a dream and therefore you can change the circumstances of the dream.
Huh.
That was this thing. And I remember for many weeks trying that. And then eventually, like, there was this one time I remember going, aha, this is a dream. I therefore have some autonomy in this situation. And that was the first time I kind of felt like I was listening. I don't know if it was part of the thing about dreams is that the logic of it flows in and out of rational to irrational. So I don't know if that was part of this moment that was rational or irrational. I don't know.
Yeah.
You seem to be interested in lucid dreaming.
Well, yeah, well, so the reason I am is honestly, through most of my 20s, I did it. I didn't mean to. I didn't like try. I didn't study it. I just could and did probably like, I don't know, 25% of the time. Mm-hmm. But what I found for me, and this says a lot about my personality, I think, my brain would always fight back. Mm-hmm. So the one recurring dream that I used to have, and again, I feel like I dream in the style of whatever media I'm consuming a lot of.
Yeah.
It's not that I think it's a movie or I dream in sort of film, is sort of what you're saying, is I think I just take the trappings or the tropes or something and my brain messes with it.
Yeah.
And I forget why, but I was watching a lot of, probably because it was college, I was watching like a lot of cartoons and like, you know, wacky nonsense things. And, One reoccurring dream I had that I could always lucid dream through was I would be stuck in like a giant sort of like Acme-esque factory.
Yeah.
And I would be tied down to a conveyor belt and going into one of those like chomper things. Like,
yeah, like the sequence in Toy Story 3.
Yes. Yeah. And then what would always happen is it'd be tied down with ropes in this conveyor belt and might always be like, ah, I'm dreaming. It's this fucking dream again. Yeah. Great. Well, you know what? I get a knife and a knife would appear in my hand.
Yeah.
And I would cut one of the ropes and I'd be like, haha, fuck you, dream. And then I'd roll over to cut the other knife and it would turn to steel.
Okay.
And then I'd die and wake up.
So it's like you were having a battle with your subconscious and your subconscious was going, nah.
Yes. And that happened every time I lucid dreamt. And it was something. And again, I think this is what got me. And that's just like a simple example of the what I can talk through that makes the most sense as quick as possible and doesn't sound like doesn't wackadoo. Like, and the idea of this sort of shared dream space, I think, started in my head. Again, I don't believe it, but it would be so fucking cool. Because it felt like someone else truly was fucking with me.
Right.
And so I was like, what if this isn't me? Yeah. What if this is this? And then it was just sort of like, and again, I don't believe this. Yeah. I just like it.
Yeah. 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 I once acted in a podcast that was called Dream No More. And I played a doctor. This was for a friend of mine.
We got to get a clip.
You can still find this. Dream No More is still available. This is from 2017. But as I recall, the podcast was like fictionalized podcast based on real storytelling.
You're cheating on me in 2017?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Oh,
I played a sleep researcher who was explaining to someone who didn't dream what the importance of dreaming was. And I think this was based on some real research. So again, I'm like doing that thing, which is like, imagine Daniel Day-Lewis becoming an expert about Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, I know a lot about dreaming because I once played a dreamer.
dreamt once.
But it was
before.
This idea that the dream is a time for your brain to expunge its thoughts for the day or expunge ideas for the day in a sort of chaotic way. And sometimes it was great. Sometimes it was not so great.
Hey, listen, the dreams in which I'm dying were the best I've ever had.
Were they? That's also, is that Eternal Sunshine, that song?
I'm sure. I don't remember, but it feels real.
No, it's Donnie Darko.
Yeah, well, it is in Donnie Darko. I just didn't know if it was also in Eternal Sunshine.
Yeah, yeah. And Michelle Gondry did the video for it. It's a cool video.
Okay, yeah.
Michelle Gondry's music videos are like lucid dreams. Yeah. They're pretty incredible. We're here to talk about Dream Scenario. I'm excited to talk about Dream Scenario. Before we talk about Dream Scenario, and I think this will be relevant, we have an email from Muhammad and his top 10 of 2023. Hi, guys. Hope you're doing well. First, thank you for reading my last email. My brother-in-law had a blast listening to your rendition of "This is the Rhythm of the Night." Oh, yeah. And now my sister is giving me the suspicious Fry look from Futurama, but I'm pretty sure I managed to stop just before going overboard. I also managed to see The Holdovers, which, in my opinion, contains the best insult of all time. And incidentally, he also saw The Zone of Interest, which made me want to take a long day-long shower. What an amazing film. Anyway, after listening to your Oscars episode, I just wanted to share with you my top 10 of 2023.
All right.
Starting at number 10, Oppenheimer. Number 9, Wonka. Number 8, Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves.
Yeah, yeah.
Number 7, The Killer. Number 6, American Fiction. Number 5, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, Part 1. Number 4, John Wick, Chapter 4. Number 3, Killers of the Flower Moon. Number 2, The Holdovers. And number 1, The Zone of Interest.
Nice.
Wishing you all the best, Hassan. That is an interesting list because it has Dungeons and Dragons on there, a film of yours. Mm-hmm. Killer, a film I didn't put on my list, but I wish I had. John Wick Chapter 4, which I'm wondering if we should have done.
We should have. I mean, look, there's interest. I really liked it.
Yeah. Does it get over the thing that I've always had a problem with John
Wick? Absolutely not.
Which is that it feels repetitive.
No. In fact, this straight up, John Wick 4 is one of the most beautifully shot John Wicks. It is also the one that like wears its welcome out the fastest.
Okay.
Like that movie, in my opinion, could be cut down by 45 minutes.
Okay.
Like, but it is a ride.
Yeah.
And everything you're seeing is gorgeous. And like the craftsmanship behind all the stunts and the action sequences are top notch.
Yeah.
But they just keep going.
Yeah. That was my deal in John Wick 2 and 3.
And it does, in my opinion, hurt it a little bit.
Okay. Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, which is a film I think neither of us, I actually revisited it recently and I was like,
I liked it. I remember liking it.
I found it to be one of the weaker ones.
Yeah.
Killers of the Flower Moon, which I don't think was in either of our lists.
Nope.
But there's number 2 and number 1 from memory is your number 1 and my number 1.
Yes.
So this is Hassan, you or Muhammad, you have clearly done the homework, read the assignment, and joined forces right in the middle between Matt and Shahir. We appreciate you being at the center of us. And this is the only podcast about movies. Thank you. Goodbye.
That's it?
That's it.
Oh, the rest of this podcast is a dream.
Is a dream. Ooh.
So Nick Cage.
We've done a couple of Nick Cage films on this podcast.
We've done Pig. We've done Jiu-Jitsu. We've done...
Mandy.
Mandy.
We've done the unbearable weight of...
Massive Talent.
Massive Talent. We have done...
That might be all of them.
That might be all the Nick Cages we've done.
Too bad we don't have a database of the actors of the movies that we've done podcasts with.
I'm sure that someone could invent that.
Yeah, invent it with technology.
No, well, also Into the Spider-Verse.
Sure.
Yeah,
he's good. He's in it.
He's in it. He's a... We've talked about, I think in our Unbearable weight of Massive Talent episode, we talked about the phenomenon that is Nick Cage. I think we also did this in Jiu-Jitsu. I think we also did this in Mandy. Because there is a weight of Massive Talent here, and one that is also profoundly self-aware, incredibly... dynamic one, an actor who never ever brings his B game, always brings his A game, even if his A game is not required for the film that we're watching.
Yeah,
incredible film actor. You know, sometimes a little too big for the movies he's in, but always welcome.
Yeah, it feels like it's funny. There's going to be some elements of Dream Scenario that I'm going to talk about in conjunction with sort of Nicolas Cage's career, or at least the perceivedness of it. Mm-hmm. That it all kind of like that over the topness. I feel like Nick Cage was always an intense actor. Mm-hmm. And then when he did one or two like really intense things, that's when the internet started really like that's around the time of like the birth of internet memes. And mm-hmm. then he became a meme, and then he like played into it. And then I feel like now he's kind of gone back a little, not that he's like calmed down or gotten more like normal, yeah. But like, I think that hump is over, and now he's sort of like an amalgamation of, you know, people grow and change and whatever. And he's the last few projects of his have been interesting, like Reinfeld, which I did not see.
You didn't see it. But it feels there's nothing more Nick Cage than
playing Dracula,
playing Bela Lugosi's Dracula.
Yeah.
You know, like a really specific Dracula.
And I'm always whenever, I mean, I think Jiu-Jitsu is
the tax write-off
was a tax write-off, but also proves that like if Nick Cage is in something, I will at least give it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
Like no matter how weird it seems, yeah. or bad, because there's always something except for in Jiu-Jitsu to enjoy.
I think the thing is, like, Nick Cage's career hinges around the Oscar win for Leaving Las Vegas.
Sure.
And that is the point where we suddenly realize that Nick Cage, this actor, leading man of the late 90s, you know, films like Moonstruck. Was he in Moonstruck? He was in Moonstruck. Yeah, of course he was. Breaks out and wins an Oscar for Leaving Las Vegas. Incredible performance, Mike Vickers' film. But then goes on to do the trifecta of greatness, which is Con Air, The Rock, and Face Off.
Yeah.
You know, like, and those are three, the pinnacles of 90s action cinema, yeah. Right? Like, those are the greats. You know, his hair blowing in the wind in Con Air, there's nothing great. And for a recent Oscar winner to be in such peak physical condition as well,
mm-hmm.
remarkable stuff. And then kind of still flirts with the idea of the Leaving Las Vegas actor, but it's never quite the same. I don't think he's ever done a performance that's quite like that.
No.
So for me, the one that really stands out is him playing Charlie Kaufman in Adaptation, which for me kind of signals the sort of self-awareness that he's kind of getting into,
mm-hmm.
the sort of sense of it. But, you know, like people love the National Treasures when he's going to steal the Declarations of Independence.
This is the one.
This is the one. The Wicker Man, as far as memes go, oh no, not the bees. I believe The Wicker Man is another Mike Figgis film. He played a Marvel character in Ghost Rider, as well as the black and white Spider-Man. You know, he's got quite a career behind him. And, you know, has taken us to some really interesting places. I think Kick-Ass was one of the first films that really got into the idea of a superhero parody in the mold of the Marvel films that we were kind of starting to be introduced to. There'd been superhero parodies before that, of course, but this was one that felt like it was in the mold of those films. And his rendition of...
I don't know if that was a parody.
A play. It's a play.
It's a play on the thing.
Yeah, parody might be not the quite the word for it. A satire.
I don't know if it was even a satire. It falls into
it's like The Boys.
Yes, yeah. Which I don't think it's playing off, and I don't think The Boys is a satire either. I think that it is a weird, dark, and twisted take on all things superhero. Like, a satire to me is whatever from those Not Another Teen movies, like the superhero movie.
I think whatever. That's parody. That's where you're making fun of the conventions. Satire is exaggerating the conventions.
Oh yeah, no, sorry, I'm getting them mixed up. Still, I don't think The Boys and I don't know.
Yeah. Any linguistic experts or
email us and tell me I'm wrong.
Early film students or early literature students will be able to answer that for us. It has been a while since I've made a distinction between satire and parody myself. There's a lot to this career. So I think there's something inherently delicious about someone who has been so gleefully memed by the internet and so willingly to meme himself, play a character who appears in everybody's dreams, playing no less, kind of in the mold that he did in Kick-Ass, a schlubby version of himself, a very, very schlubby version. And one that's really interesting to watch because it plays so much against what we understand of Nick Cage's persona. I mean, it's even startling when you see him on the red carpet talking about Dream Scenario.
Because it looks so freaking different.
It's like night and day.
Yeah. It's definitely a transformation to him to be, I think, what was his name? His character's name was Paul Matthews.
Yeah. The everyman.
The everyman.
The zebra of the academic world.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Like, yeah. That was a really good tie-in in the beginning of the movie. He obviously is in his class teaching, and he talks about what the protectiveness of a zebra's stripes are, and it's not that that stands out. It's that when you're all together, you can't see the one zebra, and anyone zebra who sticks their head out, that's the one that's going to be targeted.
Yeah.
And that's a running theme throughout how this movie treats what happens to him.
Yeah.
What did you think of the movie?
Do you want to tell us what Dream Scenario is about?
No, but you know what? Here's what I'm going to do.
Okay.
I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to have IMDb tell you. An ordinary family man finds his life turned upside down when strangers suddenly start seeing him in their dreams.
I was expecting to think that this was a fun idea that didn't have legs. I really was. I don't know why. I kind of felt like when I saw and understood what the idea was, and perhaps given Nick Cage's recent output, which I have to admit, I have a lot of strengths in them, but don't feel like fully realized ideas for movies. Like Mandy didn't quite work for me.
Mandy didn't, but Pig did.
Unbearable weight of immense talent, whatever it was, unbearable talent.
Unbearable weight of massive talent
didn't quite work for me. Pig, I thought, was much better than I anticipated it to be, but I also felt like a little bit of the world building was unusual to me.
Yes, the second act of Pig is a little bit questionable.
Yeah, it's the John Wick of shifts.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. But I have to be completely delighted in the fact that I was completely wrong. This is one of the most fully realized Nick Cage movies and one of the most fully realized concepts executed beautifully. And I was very surprised to hear reviewers that I really like disagree with me on that, because I did find this so utterly compelling and with such a brilliant understanding of how to play the metaphor in such a way that we just spent the first 10 minutes of this podcast talking about dreams. This movie's not about dreams at all. This is using dreams as a metaphor to explain both virality, memes. I think they even mentions memetics in there. He mm-hmm. plays in an evolutionary biologist, which Richard Dawkins was when he came up with the phrase memes mm-hmm. or memetics. And I just found this delightful, funny to watch, right on the nose in terms of how it's pitching its metaphor, and delivers a third act that for me absolutely nailed both the absurdist tone of what they were going for and expanded further than I thought the film could go. It's brilliantly executed as well. I think you and I are both editors. Mm-hmm. There's a sequence in this film that really draws attention to the editing, and it's a brilliant, brilliant moment because it highlights, like, is this a dream? Is this not a dream? And then there's a sharpness to it that really works. I loved this film. I flat out loved every minute of this movie.
I am honestly right there with you. It's weird. This is a movie that I absolutely, thinking about, love and I think did all of the things you just said in spades. Afterward, I just felt bad. I couldn't quite place it. I felt awful. And that's not like I don't think that's the movie affected me obviously in some way, but like I couldn't like get out of a funk after I watched it. And again, I was like, it was kind of confused. I was like, I really think this movie is great and it works. And like, oh my God, what an amazing allegory for not only like the concept of virality or sudden unwanted and then wanted and then not wanted fame. Or you could look at it as literally a dissection of Nicolas Cage's career. Like there's a ton of different ways to kind of go into this thing, which I thought were fascinating. They balance them all on this weird knife's edge and I'm here for it. And so when coming into this podcast, I knew I was going to like sing praises of the movie, like, because I do really think it lands honestly nearly everything it attempts. I felt awful afterward.
Okay.
And I don't know why. I'm hoping by the end of the podcast I figure out why.
Let's work through this. Yeah. Let's pull up a couch.
Yeah. Enough room here, but
That's interesting. You know, the film, I just watched the Benny Safdie, Nathan Fielder, Emma Stone TV show, The Curse.
Yeah, I've heard such good things.
I just watched that, and I found that the feeling you're describing of feeling awful at the end of it, I would find at the end of every episode, I would just feel bad. But not because, and I think it came back to similar feelings of when I watched The Office. You would wonder if you were... There's sort of a lack of self-awareness that those characters have in both The Office and The Curse that you start, for me, I start wondering, is like, am I that like unaware of how I'm navigating the world that this is how people see me?
Yeah.
And that's what made me feel bad about it. And I think there's a similar quality to the way Paul Matthews navigates the world here, because there's a thing that happens, which is that He is a professor who maybe feels invisible in some way. He wants recognition for the work he's done. He coined the phrase intelligence, and yet has not received any recognition for such, and eventually has that idea taken from him. He wants to write a book, and he's a tenured professor, and he wants people to acknowledge it. And, you know, but not in a sort of outwardly bad way. I think in a way that almost everybody wants to be seen and wants to be acknowledged.
Yes.
And then something interesting happens, which is that people start to see him, and not in the way that he can control, and not for any reason of anything that he has done. And that sends him into this like unusual space, which is that he is now being seen, and he sees it potentially as an opportunity, kind of muffle, like, you know, messes up every opportunity he has, but not because he's a bad person. He just hasn't quite been here before and doesn't necessarily know how to navigate this.
It's funny. I don't think labeling someone a bad person or not a bad person, I think he's a flawed person.
Yeah.
I think he, as are we all in our different special ways. I've known people like this that maybe whether they do or do not deserve recognition for a thing will never sort of like outright ask for it, but sort of like backhandedly
they want it.
But like in social situations, they want it. Yeah. But like the like sort of like dance around a thing as opposed to just asking for it, and then or like asking for it but not understanding the social cues of going around a thing. Like there's those elements to it. But the moment that really, you know, got me and it's just, I found it, excuse me, so interesting when you look at sort of Nick Cage's career. And I just watched a interview on IMDb, actually, with him talking about how this was like one of his favorite movies he's ever done. And it sounded like he believed it and it wasn't just sort of like a press thingy.
He said that a couple of times recently. And I don't think that's because he's being insincere. I think he's just genuinely finding projects he likes.
Because, well, and I also think that this project, based on what he said, he was talking about when the Nick Cage memes were starting to happen, and he was looking at them and he was like, I don't know how to process this. I don't know what to do with this. This isn't why I started acting. This isn't why I want to be famous.
Yeah.
I don't want to be famous for this.
Yeah.
And But then you kind of try to ride it, right? Yeah. Because like there is opportunity there.
Yeah.
And so I found that sort of outlook, just thinking about him, or as little as I know him.
Yeah.
Like this must have felt incredibly personal, because what is the closest thing to a mind worm or a dream, but like memes that are just being constantly shared across social media because everyone's just seeing them. Nick Cage's face was popping up to all of us, and yeah, we didn't ask for it. Yeah. Some of us liked it, some of us didn't. And Nick Cage had no say in it.
Yeah.
So like there's just an interesting comparison to his character here, because and I think that the arc that the movie takes is also very interesting. Like and it doesn't ever go so hard as to say like, oh, well, the dreams are positive until he does something and then they're negative. He starts questioning.
Yeah.
If things he's done, and even a negative thing that he does, if that was sort of the turning point or whatever. But we're never given that, like, and we don't need it. It's the same way that people on the internet, I think, feel. I mean, I even as a minor Z-list internet celebrity myself, I get, you know, weirded out when or not weirded out. What's the word? Like, I will be negatively affected if if I am, you know, misunderstood or people attack or something like that. You know what I mean?
Isn't one of our greatest fears, my fear, and it might be yours as well, is that we have put out 8 years of podcasts that any point of which could be taken out of context and become its own thing. And like one of the fears is like, what is the thing that I might have said that in a recorded format over the last 8 or so years of 400 something episodes that could possibly be taken out of context? And despite the 400 and something episodes and 8 years of work we've put into the show, that becomes the thing.
Sure. I mean, that's always a fear. I think how I've logically moved around that, because now, I mean, there's, you know, for as many hours of us on the internet, I think there's probably
more of double or triple
with me, you know, credits and history. And that definitely is a fear as well. But at the same time, it's one of those things that I'd feel weirder about if I didn't control all of the originals of the files. Cause like, yeah, definitely like things get out of context and whatever, but then there's the fear is like, oh, it doesn't matter if you can just be like, oh, look, cause no one cares. Cause they've moved on. Like anyway, this movie does a really good job of ramping up that anxiety.
Yeah. That tension of like being out of control of your image.
Because you don't, at the end of the day, when you are any sort of public facing figure, you don't have full control over your image. I mean, there are people that kind of do, but that costs so much money. We're talking like Taylor Swift, Bill Gates money. Like,
yeah. The Tom Cruise is a person like, so in control of his
and
image.
Even then there are the minor places. They just don't get into the mainstream. So when someone like us who does not have nearly enough to deal with any of that, does it. And because, and this is the other thing, with the ubiquity of technology and the way that fame happens now, none of us would be prepared.
No.
Like, and you don't really, it's a weird thing. So like, and then seeing this movie sort of go from like, oh, this is a neat positive thing. Haha. To wait, what? Oh, I don't like this. Oh God. Like by the end of this movie, sort of getting into the deeper spoilers, like he's now showing up in everyone's nightmares.
Yeah.
And they are scared of him.
Yeah.
And you think that's as bad as it can get. And then they all just fucking hate him.
Yeah.
It's like this ride of what happens to, I think, any person that we as a society put up on a pedestal that cannot control that they got put there.
Well, even people who do control, you know, the way they get put on pedestal, like people who've worked hard to achieve a sort of sense of virality or acclaim or have done something you know, on the internet that suddenly goes viral and they're very proud of it. You know, I think the thing that's always interesting to watch is when you see someone on the rise, like for me, and it's a horrible thought, is like, I'm always kind of wondering what is the turning point for this person? Mm. You know, like what is the point when that turns around? Like, you know, we talked about this, Anne Hathaway talked about this recently, which is that she's an incredibly successful actor. And then through really no fault of her own, other than being eager, you know, people started disliking her. Disliking her work. And she talked about that recently in an interview about her work with Chris Nolan. She said something along the lines of like, Chris Nolan hired her when nobody else would, yeah, because there was this sort of general distaste for her in leading in movies. I'm thinking back to, like, this has all been accelerated by the internet. And one of the great things about this movie is that it never tries to explain the logic of what is going on at all, because it is not concerned with that.
No.
What it's concerned with is the idea of a person becoming embedded in someone's consciousness. And I think that is exactly what a meme is. You know, I was thinking about, like, what are the famous memes that we have grown up with. And it's weird because they come and go so fast that for our children, they will have been, you know, they won't even exist. But, like, the one I was thinking about was the ridiculously photogenic guy. Do you remember him?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the runner who was running the New York Marathon. Someone took a photo of him. He became the ridiculously photogenic guy. And, you know, I don't know what happened to him since then.
Overly attached girlfriend.
Overly attached girlfriend. The kid burning the house on fire, or fist bump baby.
Yeah. And some of these, it's funny, some of my bigger ones are more corporate-y, like the why not both? The little girl.
Yeah.
But that's from a commercial. That's from a commercial. So it's not quite the same.
Because as Michael Cera points out in this film, every brand is wanting to attach themselves to the sense of virality that is in this. And you can see it in the way commercials are made now, which is that they're meant to design, they're designed to try and attract one part of the absurdity of virality,
yes,
right? Like, you know, like create a character. You know, this is a bad example, but the Allstate, the insurance lady, mm-hmm. Flo, the insurance lady, is like, that could be a meme, and we could potentially see the memification of that. And that's very valuable to a brand.
The other one is Mayhem.
Insurance companies really want to be memed.
Insurance companies have Ostrich Cops and Arnold now.
If you can get on SNL, if you can have your commercial be parodied on SNL, then I think you're in good stead. But it's primarily insurance companies seem to be doing it. I love that journey that this takes from absurd in the way that a Charlie Kaufman movie was, so like adaptation or Being John Malkovich, another sort of self-aware film, mm-hmm. But really pinpoints the kind of relationship that the public has to this. And I think it'd be hard pressed to find an audience that doesn't understand what's going on by the time Paul ends up in the thoughts office.
Yeah.
Like understanding, it doesn't matter that it's dreams. It doesn't matter that we don't really understand the logic, but this is something very familiar that we've seen right now. And you can see everywhere, you know, the guy that I think, I think he's really great, is Keith Lee on TikTok, right?
I don't know who that is.
He's a food critic on TikTok.
Okay, cool.
He's really great, really positive energy. But he's gotten so big now that you can start to see that there are people trying to claw away at him. And this is not an endorsement or positive review of him or whatsoever. I'm just using him as an example of, like, I can certainly foresee through the prism of this movie the kind of situation that Keith Lee might find himself in should something turn, should the public consciousness turn against them. And it's interesting to think about the public consciousness in the sort of evolutionary biology way that the film kind of alludes to, which is the lion being hunted, you know, the zebra being hunted by the lion, and what it means to stick out and eventually, like, have that come at you.
Well, the interesting thing is that we also, you know, humans beings are also the lion, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah, like, exactly. The human consciousness is the lion.
It's so strange. And listen, we've said this a bunch of times on the podcast. I know this is a quote that goes around all the time, is that a person is smart, people are stupid.
Men in Black.
Yeah. Like I think that's very, very, very true. And I think I'll also go as far, and this isn't as clear cut, but a person is kind, people are cruel. Because when you get to sort of a mob mentality, or you get in what the internet is kind of capable of turning into, is sort of a hive mind. Everyone wants to have their say. And if it feels good to agree with people, it feels better to be correct. And like we take Anne Hathaway's a great fucking example. Mm. Like I think Anne Hathaway might've been the first time I clocked that, like, this doesn't make any fucking logical sense. Mm. Like, maybe I just never paid attention before, because I always see the hate for Anne Hathaway, and I'd be like, why? Mm. Like, what? Why? She's a good actor. I don't
you,
like.
You can see it happening during the Oscar season to Bradley Cooper. In the sort of pursuit of the Oscar, there was a lot of backlash against him, and he was just genuinely being sort of a nice guy.
But
it's similar to the thing.
But like, I think human beings in groups, therefore the internet, you know, people that maybe whose lives are not going as best as they could be or have a sadness. I mean, listen, the world is a fucking shitty, scary place. Yeah. So there's no shortage of sadness in the world. And I think some weird primal old reaction that people have with sort of group mentality is to tear down people that they see possibly finding success places.
There's a great book. So You've Been Publicly Shamed by John Ronson, which I read a couple of years ago. And it basically looks at some examples of people finding negative virality. So the example they talk about, I can't remember the person's name, was the woman who tweeted, she was getting on a plane to Africa for a vacation.
Oh my God.
And she tweeted a joke that wasn't poor taste. However, it was not, it was the kind of joke that South Park would get away with. And I think she made this point as well. And while she was in the air, that tweet went viral. And when she landed, the world was against her and she lost her job. People were waiting for her at the airport. There was this immense sort of like, as what John Ronson calls, you know, a public shaming.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he likened it to the old days of like a public whipping post, where someone had to be torn down in order to both set the guidelines for how the culture will work, but also allow culture to, or, you know, the sort of populace at large to vent itself. And I think there is something to that in this film. Well, I don't know if in this film, but I find in popular culture and in the sort of, you know, silly popular culture that we talk about, like, and people who dislike Anne Hathaway, it's not really a consequence. It's just a strange thing.
Well, it's a consequence to her career.
It's a consequence. I mean,
she's not getting like, you know, strung up in a square, but like they're.
It's not like, it's an actor, you know, like who's a public figure. It's not, I'm trying to think of an analogous example that has like some more weight to it.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. The interesting thing is the psychology, and I've read a couple things about this. I wish I could place where the psychology of it is similar.
Yeah, you're right. She's an actress. It doesn't matter if I jump on.
And that's what people think. But like in her head or anyone in that position's head, the attack or the negativity or the constant bombardment, your brain, the primitive part of your brain doesn't understand, like, can't work through that. Like, it's still, you are being attacked.
Yeah.
Now you have to defend.
Yeah.
And it that's not to lessen or greaten anyone's pain in a specific instance. It's just, that's how we've, as humans, prove our mind works with these.
Yeah. Yeah. And I certainly agree with that point. I think the thing I'm thinking about there is that what happens is, because it's of low consequence in terms of the effort required to, in order to jump in on the pylon, especially these days, is that everyone feels that they should, or they have a voice and they can jump in, you know, join the conversation. When, you know, and all it does is kind of create this sort of compounding of a public sentiment, which is what happens in this film. You know, Paul literally does not attack anyone, nor does he like purposely invade anyone's consciousness. Yet because that is happening, he finds himself in a strange position. And, you know, he awkwardly tries to gain some control of that position and even try to use it to his advantage, you know, specifically for his academic advantage. You know, like, he wants to write a book, which hopefully find that there is some opportunity because of this fame to get that book published. Unfortunately, what ends up happening is he writes a book about the virality of it. So, I mean, you know, it becomes that French book, I Am Your Worst Nightmare,
yeah.
or something like that. But I think...
Sorry. I was just going to say that the turning point in this movie is, I think, when he cheats on his wife. And there's an interesting thing there, because the young woman who is dreaming about him in a sexual way, that's almost like a violent sexual fantasy.
Whatever it is. Yeah.
Whatever it is.
Yeah.
She invites him back to her place and all this other stuff.
She wants to recreate the...
Right.
Yeah.
And I've sort of read that as... This, he was being a scumbag cheating on his wife, of course, but like, this was the moment that he actively tried to truly get something or get away with something or do something untoward with his fame.
Yeah.
And that was what the hive mind. And again, the movie doesn't go into this. I'm just sort of like in the process of this sort of happening in other places in real life. Like the second you try to like grab the thing that like, no, like I'm laughing with you or like any of that, people are gonna be like, fuck you. Or they'll change and do something else and it will become negative.
Yeah.
And that was sort of my moment where I'm like, I don't think like the movie's saying like, oh, he cheated, so now the dreams are negative. I don't think that's what it's doing. I think, but it's a great sort of starting point of like, oh, here he is trying to immorally gain something from what's going on.
Yeah.
And the act of sort of acknowledging and doing that will now change the narrative of the consciousness.
I think what it's smartly doing in a way though is changing the audience's perception of this character.
Yeah.
So it's like, because the film is trying to take us on the same journey as it. And at the beginning, it seems like he's being treated unfairly. It seems like it's an unusual thing that suddenly he's going to become famous. It then uses the scene, which is probably one of the best scenes in the movie, by the way. Again, the construction of these sequences are so good. It's hard to like downplay how well made this film is. But like we see her fantasy, then we see them have a conversation about the awkwardness of this fantasy and realize that this is more for her and she wants to explore it further. Then we see them go back to the apartment and try to recreate the fantasy, which is exactly the scene that we had seen before, but far more awkward and unusual, and it's failing at every corner. And oh my God, did I laugh out loud at flatulence in this movie during that sequence.
That was so funny.
I loved it. But I think what's smart there is that the film is then saying, this person is capable, or we as an audience can view him in the way that people in the movie who are dreaming about him are viewing him.
Yeah.
And I think that's an incredibly smart turning point for the film to have, which is that he is a character capable of doing something bad. And therefore we should not take him that way. And I think what's great about that, why I think the movie works, is that it is an exploration of that character. Mm-hmm. And then I think the ride that we go from that point onwards into like him trying to capitalize on this, you know, like the failing of his marriage, even to the point where, you know, like the advent with, I think it's Nicholas Braun from Succession, you know, like the advent of a dream commercial dream machine.
That's sort of the last thing I wanted to really touch on.
I love that so much.
It's really, it goes as far as you've just said with the personalization of him, and even to the point where they have him put on like a Freddy Krueger knockoff.
He still kind of like plays into it.
Because what can he do?
Yeah. And it reminds me a lot of like Ben Affleck in Gone Girl. When he like smiles, you know, like he's being dragged into the situation and he doesn't know what to do. And one mistake kind of like turns everything for him and he doesn't realize it's happening. Like when Paul kind of puts on the Freddy Krueger thing, you go, oh boy, this is not going to go good for you. Like nobody's looking out for him.
Well, the thing that I think it actually, you're right. The entire movie, we sort of, it is about Paul and that experience, but I think it's about the general experience of virality and the stages of it.
Yeah.
And the last stage of virality, it actually has nothing, even less to do with the person or thing that has gone viral. And it is the commoditization and the capitalization of whatever is viral. And so in this movie, it is, oh, well, they invent ways to give you ads in your dreams.
Yeah.
This has been something, I think I brought this up on the podcast before, but there's a comic book called Transmetropolitan.
I have a copy of yours.
Do you?
Yeah.
Is that the one that I'm missing?
Are you missing one?
Oh, yeah. I put them in storage and I couldn't find one of the Transmetropolitan.
I have it.
Great. Okay. I still have the full set. But there's a thing in that, there's a whole bunch of just sad, like real depressing future tech in that.
I think about my feed all the time.
It's a dystopian future. In that comic there, they've invented things there in capsules or odors that companies spray in streets and in stores throughout the day that legally causes you to dream about their product for a certain amount of time. And that to me, it happens basically in this movie, is like, oh, well, now you can, if you consent to this thing, like you can get ads in your dream, like all this. And it's like, ugh.
I actually think there's one, if we're talking about the six stages of acceptance here or whatever, you know, like is the there's actually a stage after that for the character himself, which is the absence of virality and the sort of long, despite the pain of it, the longing to go back there, you know, and that's when he writes that book and he's now living this life and he is trying to inject himself into other people's dreams. You know, like it is the he is now searching for the he is now living through the absence and wanting to go back. Small case in my life. I used to make parkour videos. You know what parkour is?
Yes, Shahir, I know what parkour is. The reason I'm making a face is every time I think I've heard everything about your life, you're like, did you know that I'm actually a hang gliding champion?
And I'm have like, I not told you the parkour video story?
No.
Never? I thought you were like rolling your eyes because it was like, I've told the story a million times.
Listen, I've heard the Black Power Ranger. I've heard a bunch of other ones. But so, no, I don't think I've, although watch, someone will go back and be like, actually in episode 78, he told about the parkour video.
Well, I used to make parkour videos in New Zealand. And there was a really funny thing that happened, which reminded me of this as well.
Funny thing happened on the way to my parkour?
Well, it was a funny thing that happened on the way to making a music video that I was working on. I was working on this music video that was taking me 6 months to finish. A lot of visual effects. Every weekend I was in the studio with like two or three other people. We were like rotoscoping frames, yada, yada, yada. I walked outside and I saw some dudes doing parkour. I was like, let's grab a camera. Let's film some stuff. Grabbed a camera, filmed some stuff. The music video came out. Nobody watched it. The parkour video came out. It went to the front page of YouTube. Front page of YouTube global. And at that point, my email account was attached to YouTube. And all of a sudden, every time anyone made a comment, anytime anyone, I remember I woke up to like, I think 12,000 emails, like from a regular, and this is in 2004 or five. So this is the early days. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, what is happening here? And there's this excitement of going viral and kind of figuring this thing out. And then there's this absence that happens at the end of it. When you see those numbers slow down, like we got something like, I want to say like a couple of million views in like 2 or 3 days or something like that. It was a big number, and then there's this absence, and we made one or two more videos afterwards, and they did not But then we made a fourth video out of nowhere, and that too went to the front page of YouTube, and all of a sudden it happened again, and it was the riding this roller coaster of virality where I was like, I was suddenly like, I felt the drug surge kind of happening and then the absence of it and the sadness that comes when it's gone.
I think your story has nailed down why I felt awful after watching this movie. And that is that my current, a major part of my current career depends on things like virality.
Yeah.
And, you've hit the nail on the head. When that goes away, there's a lot of different things that happen. When we have duds or things like that, it really does hurt my on extra history or extra credits. It hurts my sort of my own self value because I'm like, oh God, like shit. Okay, not only like, oh no, it's not like oh, people aren't seeing me. In my case, it's like, oh, I need to pay my people. I have a business to run, and like, okay, we got to circle the wagons and figure out what's going on and like all that stuff. And because like this movie, he had like, Paul has no control over the machine.
Yeah.
YouTubers don't have control over the machine.
The algorithm is either in your way or for you.
Yeah. To the point where I have had dinner with the man who is in control of the algorithm.
You've had dinner with the algorithm.
I have.
Yeah.
He's a fucking awesome dude. But like, even being that close to the control of it.
Yeah.
He doesn't fully control, like he knows how it runs and can pull different levers and do, but like my point is I've put my fate in the hands of the gibbering mouther that is everyone who uses YouTube.
Yeah.
And I think watching this movie really put me on my back foot because I saw in a very truncated amount of time, like highs and lows of in different ways that I have experienced.
Yeah.
And I think there was a little bit of a trauma response. I know that word gets thrown around a bunch, but I think I actually
was,
lived like
experience.
What? Like, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think I was like, oh God. Cause day and night, that is what I deal with. Yeah. I need, you know, the things we make, and I try to make things, and it's the balance too, right? You deal with this, I'm sure, in Estuvanova or any of the stuff you're doing for MTV or any of that shit. It's that balance of, man, you want to make something that's valuable and good and entertaining and cool. And you're balancing that against all of the other things you have to do to get that work made.
Yeah.
The people who hired you, what they want. Maybe your ideas don't mix.
Yeah.
In my case, it's literally thumbnail and title.
Yeah. Yeah.
The
Mr. Beastification of YouTube.
Oh my God. Yeah. Like, and it's not that simple. People bring that up, and I want to make it clear that's not the problem.
Yeah.
The problem is YouTube rewards certain things. And those things change all the time. And I know for a fact.
Yeah.
Like our Sitting Bull series, which I fucking love. I fell in love with that series. I've talked about it here a couple times.
Yeah.
Did really bad numbers. And we have a couple ideas why. But one of the reasons truly is that I refuse. The team refuses. Not just me. No one wants to do this on my team to be salacious with the story of Sitting Bull.
Yeah.
I know for a fact I have two or three thumbnail ideas and titles that I could get those numbers jazzed up pretty quickly. And I don't want to do it.
Right.
And so it's that constant pull that I'm sure you feel on other ways of it's not like selling out or making clickbait. It's like, what are you comfortable doing while you're in this machine that you have no control over, but your livelihood depends on virality.
And watch the joy on someone's face when something they didn't expect to go viral suddenly goes viral. And it's that sense of recognition where it's like, you love me because you think my hat's cool. Okay, great. Here's these things I did. And there's that weird moment where it's like, they love you for your hat. And, you know, and they don't care about all the work you've put in to get to this point, and you still want to try it. And it's that weird navigation. The curse is really going to mess you up.
I don't even want to watch it.
Because the curse is the curse is about exactly the thing you're talking about. People with great intentions going in and still doing things that are irresponsible and unethical and not realizing it and continuing to do it over and over and over again. And I think that's also what's happening with Paul Matthews in this film, which is that he's not realizing it. But at the same time, you know, like some of the reviews I read for this film.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that.
Yeah,
I was
talked
curious
about how they disliked the character so much and how despicable he was for the way he acted and behaved and how unlikable a character he was. And I really found that challenging because I found him very human in his flaws. Like I understood that, yeah, this is not the best response to this, or, you know, like he's clearly not reacting in the best possible light here, or there's a difference between his idealized version and the version that he actually is. But at the same time, those are very human flaws. And I found that the film was so smart at giving us those distinctions. So for example, the one of the first cases of this is when he's going to visit, have coffee with his old professor, his old colleague.
His old girlfriend.
His old colleague at the beginning, whom he suspects has plagiarized some of his work or is not going to credit
that's
him.
That's right. That's
and,
right.
And his wife asks him to record the conversation. And he's like, I guess I'll think about it, you know, in a very sort of, and that's a great response. Then he records the conversation and there's such a gap between the person that like wants to just have a polite conversation with this colleague and the person he actually is, who like blatantly accuses her of plagiarizing an idea he had, that like the film is so smart in showing us those two distinctions, which is that there's a version of him that he believes he is. And then there's a version of him that comes out when he's pressed in the wrong situation because he's a socially awkward person, because he hasn't had to deal with this kind of thing before in his life. And I just find that was actually so relatably human.
Yeah, this would have been a less strong film if we just really liked him.
If we really liked him, yeah.
And I didn't dislike him. I thought some of the things he did were stupid or one or two were sort of deplorable. But like at the same time, like, this would not be a person I'd be like, oh man, I don't like this person. This would be a person be like, oh, do we want to invite him to dinner? No.
But also I was like, I felt bad for him that he had like wanted to be invited to dinner for so long and then finally was for the wrong reasons and then asked to leave because of something like nothing that he did.
Yeah, it's funny. There's a lot of sort of like negatives to him that aren't, that are due to him. And there's a lot of negatives around him that are not due to him. Yeah. And it's, I just want to go back. And I think Nick Cage is the perfect actor for this, because you can get, you can have a despicable character that you don't like, but also Nick Cage is really good at, I think, showing the humanity of a despicable character that you don't really like.
It's so unusual that Nick Cage is in such a de-glamorized format in this film that, but also completely embodies it in a certain way. Like, his gait when he walks is very not Nick Cage. Yeah. And it's very specific, but it also feels incredibly lived in. Mm-hmm. And it's like, feels like that is the way this person has walked his whole life. And it's such a great embodiment of that character. I love that performance so much, to the point, I'm kind of with you, which is that I can't imagine another actor doing this film.
No, it would be very strange.
And it would be fascinating for Tom Cruise to do it, for example, or it'd be fascinating for, another viral actor to do it or something like that. But I think it's really interesting, the choice of actor here. And I think the film is smart enough not to shy away from that. I mean, this is, again, we could have done this in 2023. We didn't for a number of reasons. I'm glad we eventually got to see it, but Christoph Borghelli, take my money, I'm all in now at this point. This is such a strong debut. It's not his debut. It's actually his third film, produced by Ari Aster as well. It's the film that it actually kind of made me think about as well. It was released on the Criterion Collection recently, but it's one of my favorite Orson Welles film is the Trial, the Franz Kafka adaptation with Anthony Perkins kind of like walking around being accused of a crime, but having no idea what the crime is or how the system that is going to help admonish absolve or punish him works. And that's what's happening to Nick Cage in this movie. He's walking around uncertain of why this is happening or how it works. And he is constantly being punished for it. And there's no way to escape it. And there's nothing he's done to get himself into the situation.
And it doesn't matter if he's a good person or bad person, because it's not this movie and what's happening to him isn't because of some moral or ethical or spiritual judgment.
Yeah.
It's just human nature.
And that's the reality of what happens to people in this scenario. Yeah. Like the ridiculously photogenic guy was just running the marathon. He never wanted to be part of that photo.
Yeah.
And, he took advantage of it. And I don't actually know the conclusion of that story. I hope that he became, he sold some books, bought a house, and lives his life happily ever after being ridiculously photogenic to whomever is around him. And maybe someone stops him in the street every now and again and says, "Hey, can I take a picture with you?"
Yeah.
I think the other criticism I've seen of this film is like that the third act doesn't really know what it wants to do.
Oh, I think it does.
I really found that last dream sequence with the talking head suit and the dream is a kind of melancholy for a relationship that has passed. It was so profoundly affecting to me.
Yep.
It reminded me of the ending of Being John Malkovich, a movie that is so absurd, but has this kind of like beautifully haunting ending, which is tragic and lovely at the same time. When have we seen a film with this audacious an idea be so well connected to the real world and execute so perfectly?
Yeah.
Like this is a no notes kind of such a scenario for me. Really, really brilliant stuff. And there was a time when Charlie Kaufman ruled the screenwriting world and films like Being John Malkovich and Adaptation were the most talked about things. This is a movie like its thumbnail on HBO Max is just sort of like a very uninspired picture of Nicolas Cage. But this movie is so exciting to watch.
Yeah.
I hope if you're listening to this podcast, you get excited about this movie because I'm just blown away by this.
Yeah. It was a very nice surprise, even though it left me reeling at the end. Again, don't take that as a negative. Just take that almost as like the effectiveness of, I think, what it's trying to get across.
Is any part of this conversation helped navigate feeling?
What I said, I think I nailed it on the head is because my current livelihood and life is very much tied to elements that this movie deals with, both positive and negative.
Yeah.
I think that's what it was. Honestly, I think that's, yeah. So thanks. Thanks, podcast therapy session. This has been the only podcast about dream scenario. Shahir,
what's the scenario?
When you are not just fucking dropping bars all up in all of our subconsciouses, where can folks find you?
Here we go now. My website is at www.shahirdaud.com. That's S-H-A-H-I-R-D-A-U-D. Or my company website, Suvanova, S-U-V-A-N-O-V-A. Matt, when you are jumping off the couch, ready to exclaim that you are back in the game for going viral on YouTube, where can people find you?
You can see me on the series of tubes over at my website, matthewcarroll.com, my life and works. Don't go there. There's nothing really there yet for you, or that's current. Also, Skeletor, the number 4, Peerezy on Instagram or NPSN, and of course, Emperor MSK on Twitter. Matthew Crawlin, Blue Sky. And then please check out the good works we're doing over at Extra History and Extra Credits. By now, holy fuck, it is time. We are getting into our series on Extra History about secret societies. Ooh. And we will have released the Saturday before this episode comes out, unless you're listening on Nebula, in which case this was a week early and you're listening to this early. Thank you so much. Sign up for Nebula using our code. It really helps us out. We are going to be talking about the cult of Mithras.
Mithras.
And it is fucking fascinating.
Let me tell you about Mithras.
Yeah.
I got nothing to say.
We have a whole bunch of cults coming up. We have the
golden personality,
the Knights of the Golden Circle, Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, the Illuminati, the Yakuza. Like we're playing the hits. And,
what about the Royal Society of Kemen from the Grand Budapest Hotel?
No, they didn't make the cut.
Fuck.
Bruce Willis.
Bill Murray's gonna be upset.
And then please check out good friend of the show Patrick Willem's channel, because I was just in his latest video on basically questioning if trying to be faithful to a material that is being adapted and being so faithful is a good thing or a bad thing based around the 2 Super Mario Brothers movies.
Okay.
I was brought on to be the only person that he knew who has both a history and gaming channel to tell him the history of Mario as a character. And we had a nice over on Nebula, a 45-minute long conversation about what we thought the best video game movie was and why it's Mortal Kombat.
Okay.
It was very much a delight. Thank you, Patrick.
Think it's Mortal Kombat?
Yeah, we both do.
Right.
And we're just chatting through it. It's actually really, really fun. So please check out all that stuff. Next week.
Oh, we're going to go back into the video game world.
Oh, God, that's right. Yeah. Next week, because Shahir and I are busy bees, we're hoping to have a little treat for you. We're going to be posting the live recording of a panel that Shahir has been on multiple times. Sadly, you were not on this one.
I was invited.
You were invited.
Was I?
Yeah. Yeah.
When was I invited to this podcast?
Forever ago. I think it was actually in January. I was like, we're doing these panels. We're trying to get the video game movie one. If we do it, are you interested? And you're like, I don't know. And I was like, okay. I took it as a negative. I don't know if next time I'll push harder.
Well, yeah.
It's about have video game movies yet gotten good. We've had this conversation before, but the years have changed. There's different styles of video game movies. And we do an episode basically with me, my partner, and the Extra Credits, Extra History Studio Director Jeff, our social media director Kat, Red, a friend of the show, Red, and then, of course, Nando from Nando V Movies. So we talk about that for a while, and the audience was hot, and it was a really good time. So next week, you'll be getting that. But the following week will probably be Monkey Man in two weeks.
And this is going to be an embarrassing thing because it involves a lot of Indian mythology, of which I am like woefully unprepared and don't know much about. So it's going to be interesting because I don't know much about the Hanuman story, but I'll be curious to like do some reading because that's what I do.
There we go. Until then, hey, I hope that you listen to this podcast well into the evening, and the last thing you hear are Shahir and I's voices lulling you to sleep.
Oh, has anyone ever dreamt of us?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, 1,000%. And not in like a weird way, just like a...
What if it was a weird way?
I'm saying okay. I forgot the word just. Yeah. Not just in a weird way. I hope whatever dreams we're causing you to have are nice.
Ew.
No, not like that. Like just nice dreams. Like they're flying or some shit.
No, I'm not doing this.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.